Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the recent investigative article by the Associated Press, The Princess, the President, and the Fortune Seekers, which details the role of the convicted child molester George Nader, who is now cooperating with Robert Mueller, and the deal he brokered with Elliot Broidy, a top fundraiser for Donald Trump and the Crown Princes of the Emirates and Saudi Arabia, that led to a secret meeting in the Seychelles with Eric Prince to set up a back channel between Trump and the Kremlin, as well as use Prince's mercenary force in the Gulf to start a war with Iran. Following on from the AP report, we will speak with Paul Campos, a professor at the University of Colorado Law School, about his articles at New York Magazine. Here's a theory about that $1.6 million payout from GOP official to a Playboy model. And, hey, look, more evidence that Broidy may have been covering for Trump in that Playmate affair. We will discuss the extraordinary coincidence that 2 days after the $1.6 million payoff to the pregnant Playmate Shira Bashard to get an abortion, Trump's lawyer Michael Cohen arranged for an Oval Office photo opportunity for Elliot Broidy with Trump, which Broidy then used to get a $600 million arms contract with the Emirates. With no evidence of a supposed two-year-long relationship that Broidy has claimed to have had with the Playmate, and plenty of evidence Michael Cohen has been paying off Playmates and porn stars who have had relationships with Trump, inquiring minds want to know more. Then, with the vote in the House of 258 to 159 to roll back the Dodd-Frank regulations and the expected soon watering down of the Volcker Rule, which stops big banks from making risky bets with depositors' money, Nomi Prince joins us to examine how much we will soon be back on the path of freeing up the banksters to run wild and bring about the next Wall Street crash. She is a former managing director at Goldman Sachs and ran the International Analytics Group at Bear Stearns in London, and is the author of a new book, Collusion: How Central Banks Rig the World, which looks into what happened to the $21 trillion created out of thin air by central banks in the aftermath of the 2008 crash. Then finally, Chris McCreal, a senior writer for The Guardian US and their former correspondent in Jerusalem and Johannesburg, joins us to discuss his latest article at The Guardian, Rudy Giuliani, One Deal for OxyContin Maker to Continue Sales of Drug Behind Opioid Deaths. We'll examine how Trump's new lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, who represented the makers of OxyContin, Purdue Pharma, tried to thwart the federal prosecutor and blame the opioid epidemic caused by Purdue pushing their drug on the doctors who prescribed it, while managing to prevent Purdue from being banned from doing business with Medicare, Medicaid, and the VA, to the point where Purdue was able to make $5 billion more out of OxyContin than the leading cause of the 300,000 overdose deaths in America. And joining us now is Paul Campos, a professor at the University of Colorado Law School. He writes for both popular and academic audiences and has been a vocal critic of the American legal system in numerous articles and essays and in books such as Against the Law and Jurismania, The Madness of American Law. And he has an article at the New York Magazine called, Hey, Look, More Evidence That Broidy May Have Been Covering for Trump in That Playmate Affair. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Campos.
Good to be here.
And there's a very lengthy and well detailed and researched article at the Associated Press, The Princess, the President, and the Fortune Seeker. And it delves into the role of Elliot Broidy, the top fundraiser for President Donald Trump. He recently had to resign as the fundraiser for the Republican National Committee. And it looks as though, just to tie it in with your article about the Playmate affair, that Broidy had wanted to meet with Donald Trump. But before he was resisted for whatever reasons, I don't know. But then Broidy, through Michael Cohen, who's also Donald Trump's lawyer, arranged a $1.6 million payout to a Playmate Shira Bashad, who apparently or allegedly Broidy had gotten pregnant. And then as soon as that check cleared, the next day, I believe, Broidy was suddenly able to get the photo opportunity that he wanted with President Trump. And then almost immediately, he was able to take that photograph to the Gulf, to these patrons in the Gulf, MBZ in the United Arab Emirates and others, basically to show that he was close to Trump. And lo and behold, suddenly he gets a $600 million contract. So that's not bad. $1.6 million for $600 million?
Yeah, that's quite a successful investment, I would say. Just to clarify, what Broidy wanted was a meeting in the Oval Office with Trump, where he would be able to then peddle that to his clients in the United Arab Emirates as evidence that he was in Trump's ear in regard to changing U.S. policy vis-a-vis the Gulf states to be more favorable to the UAE and more hostile to their great rival, Qatar. And so Broidy, in my estimation, agreed to enter into a non-disclosure agreement with Shira Bashad, in which he would be paying Bashad $1.6 million in eight $200,000 installments, purportedly because Broidy had had an affair with Bashad and got her pregnant. But I've put forward the theory in considerable detail that, in fact, what happened was that Trump was having an affair with Bashad and got her pregnant. And Michael Cohen needed $1.6 million to hush her up and went to Broidy, who's an extremely wealthy businessman and huge Republican fundraiser, and presented him with a proposition, which is, we'll give you sort of maximum access that a lobbyist can have, because an Oval Office meeting is the sort of the sine qua non of of access. If you cover this for us, if you come up with this payment for us, and also, if, by the way, if you're willing to take the fall should this NDA become public, which eventually it did, and in April. And I want to emphasize here a point which I don't think has been emphasized enough, which is there's absolutely no evidence for the proposition that there was actually an affair between Elliot Broidy and Shira Bashad. The only evidence is Broidy having released a cagey and equivocal statement, which implies that he did. But there's no independent evidence of the reality of that at all. And given that the alternative for Broidy to admitting to have supposedly had such an affair is to admit that he paid a $1.6 million bribe to the president of the United States so that he could get military contracts out of his friends in the Gulf states, it's not surprising that Broidy would rather claim to have had what I see as a fictitious affair, rather than be revealed for what he has actually been convicted for in the past, which is bribing politicians. Broidy was convicted in 2009 of a felony for having bribed seven members of the New York State Comptroller's Office to funnel pension monies in New York into Broidy's hedge fund. So this isn't speculative. This is what this guy does, just as sleeping with playmates and then paying them to keep their mouths shut is what Donald Trump does. And it should have been a huge red flag to the American media that those two things were in confluence in regard to this particular story. But instead, quite scandalously, in my view, Broidy's sort of facially preposterous story has just been transcribed by the media, who continue to treat it as an established fact that Broidy supposedly had an affair with Shira Bashad, when I don't think he did. I think what he did is he paid a bribe to Donald Trump, and they used the Bashad business to cover it up.
And the person who brokered the deal, of course, Trump's lawyer, Michael Cohen. We learned today that Michael Cohen got paid $400,000 kickback from the Ukrainian government for setting up a White House meeting with the president of Ukraine. So,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, Michael Cohen is as corrupt a lawyer as you could possibly find. And by the way, he's also barely a lawyer. He has almost no – I mean, his only real client actually is Trump. And another aspect of the story, and in fact, the aspect of the story that put me onto this initially, is that it's just ridiculous to imagine that Elliot Broidy, a man who uses only the most top-tier legal talent for all his other, you know, extensive and complex legal dealings, would actually employ Michael Cohen, of all people, to handle this remarkably sensitive matter. But that's the story that has been put forth and which has been swallowed by the American media up to this point.
And again, I'm speaking with Paul Campos. He's a professor at the University of Colorado Law School. He writes for both popular and academic audiences and has been a vocal critic of the American legal system in numerous articles and essays and in books such as Against the Law and Jurismania, The Madness of American Law. And he has an article at New York Magazine called Hey, Look, More Evidence That Broidy May Have Been Covering for Trump in That Playmate Affair. The long and the short of it is that I'd heard that there'd been a whole slew of these women come by at the same time as Stormy Daniels, and that he got one of them, who was a Playmate model, got her pregnant. So is anybody working on trying to pin this down? What has been the response, by the way, from Broidy's wife? As far as I know, she hasn't divorced him, and she hasn't acted like an indignant, spurned wife.
No, I mean, that's another piece of very suggestive evidence. She's hasn't shown any indication to that she's going to leave him or divorce him or anything like that. Which might be explicable for a number of reasons, but one of the most obvious reasons is she's in on this, and she knows that this is just part of the game, as it were, and so she's just going along. She has been, by the way, she is herself as a lawyer and has been involved in some of Brody's more questionable business dealings. But yeah, again, you know, I think the point to emphasize here is that the Sherrod Bouchard affair and subsequent pregnancy and purported abortion is exactly the kind of thing that Donald Trump has a very long track record of doing. By the way, it's also well established that he has unprotected sex with these women who he has liaisons with. So that sort of fits the Sherrod Bouchard story as well. And it's also extremely well established that Elliot Broidy is a completely shameless influence peddler who goes up to and beyond the edge of the law in buying the favors of politicians for the purposes of pushing forward his business interests. And so on its face, this story should have set off alarm bells when it came out, especially now that given this, you know, this really fascinating AP story that you mentioned, that details quite carefully exactly how Broidy's machinations went down in the context of the fall of 2017, where he literally writes a check to Sherrod Bouchard, and 2 days later he's in the Oval Office pitching his clients, the UAE, to Trump, and then a few days after that he gets a $600 million contract. It's just like a completely on its face, quid pro quo. And the only part of the story which remains confirmed is this business of whether, in fact, Broidy was taking the fall for Trump in regard to this NDA with Sherrod Bouchard and also paying the money. Now, as to whether anybody else is looking into that, I don't know. But if there are any aspiring Woodwards and Bernsteins out there, I would suggest that they maybe try to confirm whether Broidy actually had an affair with Bouchard, which, by the way, there ought to be copious documentation of, because in the original story that broke this in the Wall Street Journal, it was claimed that Broidy had a 1 to 2 year affair with Bouchard in which he was paying her for exclusivity in regard to a relationship. If that is actually true, there should be a considerable paper trail, leaving aside things like emails and text messages and things of that sort, that would confirm that Broidy did have this affair. And I don't think he should be allowed to continue to push this story to the public without him confirming it in some way to journalists, rather than having journalists simply in sort of stenographic manner repeat what he's been telling them about how, oh, no, I haven't actually been bribing the president of the United States. I actually just had this affair with this playmate, which is just extremely implausible for all kinds of reasons. As I outline in a quite extensive article I wrote for New York Magazine 2 weeks ago, which the article that you're referencing from yesterday is a follow-up to. So if people want to look at exactly how implausible the whole Broidy Bouchard supposed affair is, I would suggest they look at my article in New York Magazine that came out, I think, 2 weeks ago today, which outlines why that whole story makes no sense.
And another player, of course, in this is this Beverly Hills attorney, Keith Davidson, who turns out to be essentially working against his clients. He was Stormy Daniels' a lawyer who made the NDA that now she's getting out of with her new lawyer, who seems to be quite effective. Have you tried to get in touch with Avenatti? Maybe he's the guy.
I know Michael Avenatti, and I know that he's doing excellent work in this area.
Right.
And I hope that other people follow his lead. Notice that all three of the adult industry actresses and publicly connected to Trump, Stormy Daniels, Shara Bashard, and Karen McDougal, were all clients of Keith Davidson, and all of them fired Davidson because they came to the, in my view, quite obviously correct conclusion that Davidson was actually in cahoots with Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's personal lawyer, rather than actually representing them independently as he was required by his obligations as an attorney to do. So Davidson is another just extremely shady character in this entire business, and I think he played clearly a quite nefarious role vis-a-vis Shara Bashard, because the story that Elliot Brody tells, which again doesn't make any sense whatsoever, is that Keith Davidson was contacted by Shara Bashard about the affair she supposedly had with Brody, and then Davidson contacted Michael Cohen, which doesn't make any sense because there was no connection between Cohen and Brody. Cohen wasn't Brody's lawyer. But supposedly Davidson called up Michael Cohen, told him the story about Bashard and Brody, which, by the way, is a complete breach of Davidson's duty of confidentiality to his client. And then Cohen, who, again, Brody doesn't even know, calls him up out of the blue and says, "Oh, I hear this problem you have with this Shara Bashard woman. Why don't I be your lawyer?" I mean, I can't, as an attorney, I can't tell you how utterly implausible that story is, especially since Brody only hires, the most top-shelf legal talent, and the notion that he would use Cohen, especially for something like this, is just ridiculous. So this story is completely implausible on its face, and this AP expose that came out a couple of days ago only emphasizes what the real narrative must look like, which is this, tit-for-tat trading of in which Elliot Brody pays off Shara Bashard to get rid of Donald Trump's latest girlfriend problem in return for Oval Office access, which he can use for his extremely corrupt influence peddling in the Middle East.
Paul Campos, the Associated Press has done a really thorough investigative piece available by Desmond Butler and Tom Libianco, The Princess, the President, and the Fortune Seekers, that detail all of Brody's dealings, along with George Nader, of course, the convicted child molester, of all the people to have as your emissary and fixer.
Brody also, by the way, I should mention here, Brody paid the Republican National Committee $185,000 of his own money in order essentially to pay for the right to have Trump have a photograph taken of Nader, the child molester, and the president of the United States, which Nader then could use for the purposes of his own influence peddling. So the sleaziness and corruption of these people basically goes beyond sort of like novelistic limits.
Right.
I mean, it's utterly extraordinary.
Well, I think the AP piece, though, indicates that it's not just the Russian story that is haunting Trump, but I think the Middle East story is just as compromising. Just to back to your article at the New York Magazine, hey, look, more evidence that Brody may have been covering for Trump in that Playmate affair. Brody, of course, is no matinee idol, right? I mean, it's pretty extraordinary to think that that this Playmate, I mean, I suppose if you could, for $1.6 million, I suppose you could hold your nose or whatever.
Well, the $1.6 million was after the fact.
After the fact, so exactly. So she right. must have been must be a charming person.
Well, I guess, but again, there's a lot of very rich men in Southern California, and not all of them look like Jabba the Hutt. So, she would have had a lot of options, shall we say, if she wanted to go down that route.
Right, but just to go back to the crooked NDA that this crooked lawyer, Keith Davidson, who works against his clients, as he did with Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal, and presumably since he was also Shara Bashard's lawyer, the NDA Stormy Daniels' NDA, of course, is the heart of Avenatti's suits. Is there a way to break Sherbazaad's NDA? Has anybody talked to her? I mean, she's obviously... Were you able to talk to her?
I have not been able to talk to her. I've made numerous attempts to reach out to her attorney, who won't talk to me, which is also, frankly, very suspicious under the circumstances, because if my theory about all this is incorrect, then you would think that her attorney would be out there denouncing it, saying, no, this is, absolutely untrue, and so on and so forth. But he will not respond. And of course, I haven't been able to speak to Bouchard herself. But the bottom line here is, if the federal authorities are looking into this, which I suspect that they are, I mean, I think this is probably the reason why Michael Cohen's office was raided on April 9th. I think the Southern District of New York, the federal attorneys there were probably concerned. The U.S. attorneys were concerned that evidence might be getting destroyed in regard to this whole business. If they're looking into this, the existence of a non-disclosure agreement to cover up criminal activity is not enforceable vis-a-vis law enforcement. You cannot refuse to talk about an NDA if it's covering up illegal activity. So if there was a bribe here, and what was actually going on was that Elliot Brody was bribing Donald Trump to cover up Trump's affair with Bouchard, then Bouchard's NDA is certainly no shield against that investigation.
Right, and it's worth noting that the special counsel, Robert Mueller, referred this to the Southern District of New York. He didn't think it was something in his wheelhouse, but he thought it was important enough for them to act on. So may well have been a time factor, since they sent in such a clean team along with the FBI raid on both Cohen's home office and hotel room. They really... the FBI pulled out all the stops, so it was a big deal. And obviously, they've got a lot of material. So stay tuned. Thanks for joining us, Paul Campos.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Paul Campos. He's a professor at the University of Colorado Law School. He writes for both popular and academic audiences and has been a vocal critic of the American legal system in numerous articles and essays, and his books such as Against the Law and Jurismania, The Madness of American Law. And he has an article in New York Magazine called Hey, Look, More Evidence That Brody May Have Been Covering for Trump in That Playmate Affair. We're going to take a brief station break and back look into the House rollback of the Dodd-Frank regulations. And we're speaking with Nomi Prince about the possibility of a new Wall Street crash in the pipeline. And joining us now is Nomi Prince, who is an author, journalist, and a senior fellow at the Demos Think Tank. Before becoming an author and journalist, she worked on Wall Street as a managing director at Goldman Sachs and ran the International Analytics Group at Bear Stearns in London. She was a member of Senator Bernie Sanders' Federal Reserve Reform Advisory Council and is on the advisory board of the whistleblowing organization Expose Facts. The author of All the President's Bankers, The Hidden Alliances That Drive American Power, her latest book is Collusion, How Central Bankers Rigged the World. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nomi Prince.
Thank you so much, Ian.
Well, thank you for joining us, Nomi, and your new book, Collusion, How Central Bankers Rigged the World, is extremely detailed, and it leads us to understand the roots of the last crash on Wall Street in 2008, and also to prepare us for the next. And it seems that the Congress has taken steps in that direction with voting to basically get rid of roll back provisions in the Dodd-Frank Act so that federal oversights of banks with assets of less than $250 billion will not have to face stress tests. And the House voted 258-149, approving that with 33 Democrats joining the Republicans. And in addition to that, of course, there is the fact that later in the month, regulators are expected to release a plan to water down the Volcker Rule, which prevents big banks from making risky bets with depositors' money. So how do you see those two steps? Are they steps? It sort of reminds me of under Clinton when they got rid of Glass-Steagall.
Well, it is, because if you don't restructure the banking system fundamentally, which we did not do, Dodd-Frank went some ways in trying to restructure some of the manners in which banks could trade and the capital they would have to set aside for trading. But the reality is banks, since the financial crisis, particularly the larger ones, have been rewarded for all the foul activities they did into the crisis and since the crisis by major subsidies from the Federal Reserve, by, you know, major discussions about how to deregulate them from the standpoints of Congress. And as you mentioned, that's not just a Republican thing. It crosses over the lines. Rather than doing the exact opposite, which would be using the financial crisis as a reality check on banks, on what banks can do if they're not regulated enough, and going in the other direction. That's a recipe for more systemic risk, not less systemic risk. And that's exactly what yesterday's vote will do. It just, by definition, decreases, the size by which banks have to be adhering to certain restrictions in the Dodd-Frank. It allows banks sort of at the lower levels, and not even that low, $50 billion and so forth, to sort of get out of meaningful reporting. And what that allows is for speculation to happen at the bottom of the banking system, actually not even the bottom, but sort of the mid-range of the banking system. It also allows big banks to buy these banks that now have less restrictions and, like, sort of put them in another part of their book, and sort of use their lack of restriction to segue into their own lack of future restrictions. This isn't something that just applies to a set of banks. It's something that applies to all of the banks that size and bigger.
So in terms of the broader picture that you paint in Collusion, How Central Bankers Rigged the World, it seems that the irony of the crash in 2008, it's been pretty clear that the if the banksters, as they call, were rewarded, and Wall Street was rewarded and Main Street was punished, and we had to pay the tab, Main Street. But what happened after the 2008 crash was that central bankers around the world created $21 trillion of new money to stop the unraveling of that happened in 2008 with these banks going under and the stress on the entire global financial market. So that's essentially what happened. But what happened to that money?
Well, so that money, which was manufactured, it was conjured electronically by the world's largest central banks, the ones that were connected to the most powerful countries and the most powerful private banks, emanating from the Fed's direction in the wake of the financial crisis of 2008, happened over a period of 10 years. So what we must understand in this is it wasn't even one emergency fix as it was sort of packaged in the beginning. This is something that's a pretty long decade of emergency fixing and subsidizing the very banks at the core of the crisis, not just fixing them, not just helping them over a rough patch, but literally subsidizing them with conjured money for 10 years across the world. And $21 trillion is about the size of the GDP of the United States. So if we think of just the magnitude of just the sum that was created, it is staggering. And because it was created, it has allowed rates to be low. It's allowed banks to overvalue other assets. It's allowed the Fed, the European Central Bank, the Bank of Japan, and so forth to choose what they want to buy from the private banks or companies in their jurisdiction with fabricated money, and it has made them into portfolio managers with no restrictions, no accountability, that have the ability to alter economies and alter so the financial lives of the real people in those economies. The money from the Fed went to buying government bonds and bad mortgage assets that the banks couldn't get rid of in any other way, to the tune of $1.75 trillion in mortgage assets. In other countries and regions, that money's gone into corporates, it's gone into stocks, but it's basically manufactured by central banks in order to ostensibly keep the system going. They say it's to keep economies going, but there's been no proof that economies have been helped versus the financial players themselves being helped.
So could you argue then, Naomi Prince, that what Obama should have done is let these banks go under and make Wall Street suffer the pain from their profligacy and recklessness. Would that have been a better route to have taken? Because it was pretty clear that Obama's position was to deal with the situation and not to blame anybody. And frankly, I think he let George W. Bush and the Republicans off the hook.
He did. I mean, one of the Treasury secretaries under George W. Bush was Hank Paulson, who ran Goldman Sachs while Goldman Sachs was creating credit derivative products that ultimately were at the crux of the financial crisis, and for which they ultimately had to pay settlements with the Department of Justice. And, for example, listened, did not blame him. And one of the reasons he did not blame him or sort of people in the regulatory body when he was, before he became president, was because Goldman Sachs was one of his number one campaign contributors. J.P. Morgan Chase was his banker. And so, there's reasons why blame was not parceled out on an individualized basis to the real players who caused the real crisis. There's political reasons for that. Obama was just one of the political associates of the institutions that ultimately did very well out of the Federal Reserve's policy to subsidize the major banks and the banking system and render money 0%, which means people can't save money and receive interest, and did a lot of other ramifications from that policy that we're still going to feel in the years to come.
But to the question of what would the alternative have been better, in other words, rather than manufacture $21 trillion of new money in order to rescue the global economy that the banksters had taken down, make the banksters feel the pain instead of, having to Main Street having to pay and buy up all those worthless mortgages.
Well, yes, because rather than buy up the worthless mortgage assets, not mortgages, but the assets that the bank created out of mortgages, they could have just bought out the mortgages. It would have been far cheaper. It would have been $500 billion at most to buy up the mortgages rather than $21 trillion globally on a 10-year ongoing emergency policy that central banks want us all to believe is actually helping all the main economies. So, yes, it would have been better. It would have been cheaper. Maybe one more bank would have gone under. So what? Banks go under all the time. And the result is that they get chopped up into little bits, they get merged into other banks, their CEOs go to other places, and the world goes on. And so maybe at the time there would have been some days in pain. They could have done an FDR and closed banks for a while and had them deal with their own transactions with each other. And believe me, I used to work at almost all of those banks involved. I've worked at Chase. I've worked at Lehman Brothers and Fair, who went under. I worked at Goldman Sachs. The reality is they will find a way, if there is a way, for them to survive. And if not, they won't. And it's really that simple. But none of them wanted to take the path of Lehman, obviously. And there was a government backdoor to not have to do that. And there was a bigger Federal Reserve subsidy in the wake that has now lasted for 10 years to provide all of them lots of money. I mean, Lloyd Blankfein became a billionaire. Jamie Dimon became a billionaire. These were institutions that crushed the economy, that threw people out of their homes, that devastated their pension funds at those years. I mean, and these people have gotten off becoming far, far richer than they might otherwise have become. Opportunities, and if those opportunities happen to also throwing people out of their homes or accelerating the foreclosure process that IndyMac, the company that his consortium took over, the bank that his consortium took over, was involved in, then so be it. I mean, this is not a man who has in his background anything to indicate that in his position he's going to do anything different from all the other Treasury secretaries that either came from Goldman or have the philosophy of having to save the banks and deregulate the banks and let them do what they need to do to, quote, be competitive or to, increase lending to the little person and not check whether that happens or not than any of the other people before.
Let me remind the audience again, if I can, that I'm speaking with Naomi Prince, the author, journalist, and senior fellow at the Demos Think Tank. Before becoming an author and journalist, she worked on Wall Street as a managing director at Goldman Sachs and ran the International Analytics Group at Bear Stearns in London. She was a member of Senator Bernie Sanders' Federal Reserve Reform Advisory Council and is on the advisory board of the whistleblowing organization Exposed Facts, the author of All the President's Bankers, The Hidden Alliances That Drive American Power. Her latest book, just out, is Collusion, How Central Bankers Rigged the World. So just to go back to the to your book in terms of explaining what happened in 2008 and the creation of all of this money to bail out the global banking system to make to reward the people who took the global economy to the brink of collapse. How does that relate, though, to, for example, you know, I covered the Greek story as it was going on, and the former finance minister was here in Los Angeles recently, Varoufakis. And I'd always, I always found it extraordinary that the system is such that the profligate lenders never get punished, but the profligate borrowers do. And we keep squeezing the governments for making these loans, which the big banks foisted on them, encouraged them. And Goldman Sachs did all kinds of tricks to disguise how in what desperate shape the Greek economy was in order to get them to more and more in debt, in effect. So what explains that system whereby irresponsible lenders don't get punished, but irresponsible borrowers do?
Well, I think that was actually my last book, All the President's Bankers. I mean, what explains a lot of that is the relationships between the private, the major private bankers and the major politicians, and so I expanded that into the major central bank leaders in this latest book, In Collusion, because those relationships are part of that structure of the sort of lenders or the investment banks being the ones that sort of determine where money goes, but then when they need it back, being very punitive in what they require from those countries or so forth. And that's when you have, you know, austerity measures being pressed upon Greece rather than, you know, sort of debt restructuring at the hands of or debt forgiving, and not acknowledging that one of the reasons that Greece had to take on that debt was because a lot of speculative capital went into Greece on its own. No one forced it. you know, beforehand, when it seemed like things were good before the financial crisis, and in fact, Greece was balancing its economy fairly decently at that point, when that capital flew out very quickly and left a gaping hole, that's when it became difficult for Greece to handle that. It wasn't really Greece's fault. That just was what happened with capital. But those investors were made whole, and Greece was slapped with an ongoing bailout for austerity program. And where that gets worse, and you know, I talk about this in Collusion, not just for Greece, but parts of Southern Europe and just other countries throughout the world that weren't the ones creating the free money for themselves and for their banks, but the ones who had to deal with the sort of ramifications, is that the European Central Bank made very strict decisions as to who they would help with the money they were fabricating and who they wouldn't. They decided, for example, to help Germany and Luxembourg and Holland, all the countries that were stronger and have become stronger because of that help, and banks and companies within them, whereas they decided not to help Greece. I mean, that was just a decision that they could have. They just chose not to. One of the things that President Trump has done is he's accelerated in a very, you know, aggressive way the desire of these countries to actually manage to have their own trade alliances or sort of develop agreements outside of that of the United States. So, I mean, his sort of isolationist policies and just sort of the way in which he handles the I'm going to use the term diplomacy lightly, but just dealing with other countries is to go into sort of protectionist mode, which in this world is actually detrimental to the United States itself and to the U.S. dollar. But that's something that I think was starting, I talk about this in the book, and it's one of the things that actually manifested Trump. But it was one of the things that was starting in the wake of the financial crisis anyways. These BRICS countries, as you mentioned, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa were among other countries in the emerging side of the world who wanted to find a way to deal and trade and have agreements beyond the codependence on the U.S. dollar. And a lot of that was because they were concerned, and they talked about this. I go through this in my book at various conferences around the world where they started becoming more on the same page of what the Fed was doing, of what the banks were doing, of the crisis they had just seen unfold, and the fear that the United States didn't really handle it properly. I mean, we're very insulated here, so we just assumed, or at least the narrative was, okay, banks are fine, Dodd-Frank was fine, and that the U.S. thought of itself, and Ben Bernanke, who was the chair of the Fed at the time, pushed this idea usually in Congress and in the press and so forth, that he had taken care of this crisis. Well, the rest of the world wasn't really on the same page. And I go through lots of countries and documentation as to how they, in the wake of that sort of delusion of on the part of the Fed about the U.S. banking system and the kind of risk it could impose and would potentially impose in the future on the rest of the world, was viewed by the rest of the world. And what happened was a lot of these countries and their allies started to have extra conferences and started to meet in other locations. And the new development bank, or the BRICS bank, was created. It's headquartered in Shanghai, and I visited the people that run that when I was doing research for this book, as a means to sort of not isolate the U.S., because the U.S. is a major economy and they all trade with the U.S. and they all have alliances and diplomatic ties and so forth, but to kind of create their own piece of the world that wasn't connected to the United States.
Well, Naomi Prince, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And I've been speaking with Naomi Prince, who's an author and journalist and senior fellow at the Demos Think Tank. Before becoming an author and journalist, she worked on Wall Street as a managing director at Goldman Sachs and ran the International Analytics Group at Bear Stearns in London. She's a member of Senator Bernie Sanders' Federal Reserve for Reform Advisory Council and is on the advisory board of the whistleblowing organization Expose Facts. The author of All the President's Bankers, The Hidden Alliance That Drive American Power. Her latest book is Collusion, How Central Bankers Rigged the World. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how Rudy Giuliani, Trump's new lawyer, was responsible for prolonging the opioid crisis. And joining us now is Chris McGreal, a senior writer at The Guardian US and a former correspondent with The Guardian in Jerusalem and Johannesburg. His latest article in The Guardian is Rudy Giuliani Won Deal for OxyContin Maker to Continue Sales of Drug Behind Opioid Deaths. His new book, American Overdose, The Opioid Tragedy in Three Acts, will be published in November. Welcome to Background Briefing, Chris McGreal.
Hello.
And the opioid crisis or epidemic has claimed at least 300,000 American lives, and it is considered to have ravaged the heartland of this country, in particular West Virginia, a state that voted 40% for Donald Trump, or by a 40% margin. A huge victory for Donald Trump in West Virginia and many of these other red states. And now from your article, we're learning that his new lawyer essentially let the Purdue Pharma, the maker and pusher of this drug, off the hook.
Yeah, he was hired by Purdue Pharma, Rudolph Giuliani. He'd recently stopped being the mayor of New York and had a certain cachet as the man who had been there during 9/11. He also had quite a lot of political pull in Washington as a result, and he was an experienced lawyer, so he was a natural for Purdue Pharma to hire when it was coming under increasing scrutiny for its role in essentially mis-selling its drug OxyContin. It had made a number of false claims about the drug, one of which was that it was less likely to be addictive than other opioids, that it was harder to abuse. In other words, that it was much harder pill to break down and to get an instant high from than other similar drugs, which wasn't true, and not only wasn't true, was actually particularly dangerous because OxyContin carries a much higher concentration of narcotic. And it also claimed that the pill was longer lasting than it was, so it in effect became more addictive. And it was facing, Purdue Pharma was facing lawsuits all over the place even 15 years ago, but it was facing a criminal investigation in Virginia by a U.S. attorney, John Brownlee, and when he started looking into the sharp rise in opioid overdoses and deaths in his region, that led him straight to Purdue Pharma.
Well, that's not surprising. I mean, in throughout the history of the so-called war on drugs, quite often we're told by the Drug Enforcement Administration that we're going after the drug kingpins, we're going after the source. Defoliants were used in Colombia and other countries where coca is grown, and an awful lot of resources were put into destroying jungle labs and going after drug kingpins, as you know, many of whom, of course, ended up in movies and, and television series. So that's all pretty clear history. So this is what's extraordinary to my mind. If the DEA goes after drug kingpins and their jungle labs, you don't have to go far to figure out who the drug kingpins are in the opioid crisis, and you don't have to go far to figure out where their labs are. They're not exactly in the jungle. They're huge, visible, and the Sackler family that own Purdue are quite visible in as patrons of the arts, etc. So there's no mystery, is there, in terms of that idea of going after the source of the drugs?
No, there isn't. That is why this U.S. attorney, John Brownlee, identified Purdue Pharma as the principal culprit in all of this. It's not the only culprit, but certainly it was a major player in ramping up the opioid use in this country, and particularly its drug OxyContin, which helped drive people from who were using relatively low-level opioids and may have become dependent into using life-threatening drugs, and therefore the numbers of overdoses and deaths. And that's what he concluded, and that's why he began an investigation of them. And as soon as he did, up pops Rudolf Giuliani on behalf of Purdue Pharma. And as Brownlee describes it, Giuliani pitched up essentially trying to persuade him that he'd got the entire investigation wrong, that he'd misunderstood the cause of the problem, that it wasn't the drug company selling the drugs, but the doctors who were prescribing the drugs. Brownlee had by then started digging deep into Purdue Pharma's marketing methods and had concluded that, in fact, the company was deliberately misrepresenting its pills to doctors and persuading them to prescribe OxyContin for things that the drug just wasn't suitable for, but particularly with the claim that it was less addictive. Doctors have been cautious for decades about prescribing opioids because of the risk of morphine addiction. And so this was its unique selling point. This was the thing that would persuade doctors to prescribe OxyContin over other opioids, even though it was a much stronger drug. And that's where Brownlee pressed home his case, essentially. And according to Brownlee, Giuliani slowly gave way on that, and the attempts to persuade him that there was no case turned into negotiations about what the penalties would be. And Giuliani was determined to press for a criminal conviction, and eventually persuaded that Brownlee was determined to press for a criminal conviction, and eventually persuaded Purdue's lawyers, including Giuliani, that that would be the outcome, and they'd better start talking about a plea deal.
And again, I'm speaking with Chris McGreal, who's a senior writer for The Guardian US and a former correspondent for The Guardian in Jerusalem and Johannesburg. His latest article at The Guardian is Rudy Giuliani, One Deal for OxyContin Maker to Continue Sales of Drug Behind Opioid Deaths. And his new book, American Overdose, The Opioid Tragedy in Three Acts, will be published in November. But that's not to say that Giuliani didn't try to use his political clout to intimidate Brownlee or to curb him. He went directly to James Comey, who was then the Deputy Attorney General, and complained about Brownlee, did he not?
Yeah, there were two tracks here. There was the face-to-face meetings with Brownlee, and then Brownlee later discovered that behind his back, the Purdue's lawyers were using their political muscle in Washington to try and get the investigation either pulled or slowed down. They went indeed to Comey, and in Brownlee's words, said, "That guy down there is crazy. Why is he investigating us?" And that was sorted out when Brownlee went and met Comey in person and overcame the particular issue at hand, which was his attempts to get certain kinds of internal communications from Purdue. But there was, as it turned out, relentless behind-the-scenes political pressure to try and either get the investigation pulled altogether or to get it directed away from a criminal conviction towards a civil settlement. And that was a very important issue for the company because the consequences of a criminal investigation or a criminal conviction.
But Brownlee did manage to basically get OxyContin or Purdue on the idea that of intent to defraud or mislead. And that was essentially the pillar on which he got his conviction. And my understanding is, and I may have this wrong, that the promotion campaign, the sales campaign that Purdue did for to make OxyContin a household name and therefore get millions of Americans, not millions, but I don't know, 300,000 died. So we don't know how many people have been addicted to it, but a lot of people have been addicted to it. What is it true that they spent something like $6 billion promoting this drug?
Yes, although it's breaking that down is quite difficult. But yes, they spent very, very large amounts of money. And it was probably, certainly in the words of some people I've spoken to at the FDA, it was the biggest marketing campaign they'd ever seen for a drug of this kind. Certainly, they spent very large amounts of money into the billions. Pinning down exactly what the total is quite difficult. But they had a huge sales force. I mean, it was so large that they actually had to go to another drug maker and enlist part of their sales force too, because they didn't have enough people, and also because of the nature of the connections. One of the ways that Purdue marketed this drug was it wasn't marketed to the consumer; it was marketed to the doctors, and they essentially did that by buying up data of what doctors were prescribing what kinds of drugs, and then targeting, at least initially, their sales to those doctors. So doctors who were already prescribing opioids were targeted because they could be persuaded that this was a better drug than the ones they were prescribing. And then once that they were on board and were prescribing it, the salesman would go to the doctors down the road and say, "Why aren't you prescribing this drug? Look at the sales, their prescription figures for your colleagues up the road in a different clinic. Look what they're doing. So obviously you're failing in your duty to treat pain." So there was a relentless pressure on doctors who, in fairness to them, there's certainly a good number of doctors who saw the possibility to make very large amounts of money out of this, and some of those are in prison. But many of the doctors who had no criminal intent actually also had very little training in pain. And there wasn't just by Purdue, but there was a long campaign by the industry alongside some doctors who wanted wider prescribing of opioids to make treatment of pain with opioids a big national issue. And so there was this relentless pressure on doctors to prescribe these drugs.
Well, obviously, this is a drug that would have repeat customers. That's by definition, right? It's an addictive drug. So let's get to the role, though, of Giuliani. Purdue was fined $640 million, which is apparently nothing compared to their profits. I don't recall. Can you give us a quick figure on how much money they made out of this drug at the time that they were fined $640 million?
Well, at the time, they were fined that in 2007,
right.
Although it was only for their actions up to 2001.
Right.
But at the time that they were fined it, they pulled in at least 8 to 10 billion at that point in profit on top. That's not just takings, that's profit.
Right.
The estimate of how much they probably made actually in reality by the time that they the period covered, shall we say, by the conviction was probably somewhere around $2.5 to $4 billion at that point.
But the key thing that Giuliani did, he basically prevented this drug company, Purdue, from being banned by the U.S. government, which would normally have happened. And that meant would mean that they couldn't sell to Medicare, Medicaid, or the VA. And that would be really, you know, a long way to putting them out of business. So the point of that I got from your story, Chris McGreal, is that the U.S. government missed an opportunity to nip this opioid epidemic in the bud, or at least curtail it at the height of the epidemic, thanks to Giuliani.
Yes, indeed. I mean, if there is a conviction of a company, a criminal conviction, a felony conviction, then in the usual rule of things, that company is not allowed to do business with the federal government. So that would have meant that Medicaid, Medicare, the Veterans Administration, various other federal administrations would not have been able to pay for OxyContin. Had they not been able to pay for it, not only that would that have been a very large part of Purdue's sales, but it would probably have discouraged other private entities, hospitals, whatever, from dealing with the drug anyway. So it was crucial to Purdue Pharma that the company, if there was going to be a criminal conviction, that it wasn't pinned on Purdue Pharma. And the result of Giuliani's negotiations and the lawyers around him, the company's lawyers, was that it was pinned on Purdue Frederick, which was essentially the original company that had been bought many years ago by the Fackler family. And then it had been divided up in 1991, and Purdue Pharma was the entity dealing with pain pills and pain treatments. So the criminal conviction banned Purdue Frederick from selling to the federal government, but that made no difference whatsoever because it didn't actually produce any medicines. And Purdue Pharma was free to go on selling those pills. Now, you can question about the nature of that deal. That's the deal that Giuliani negotiated. I spoke to John Brownlee, the U.S. attorney responsible for the deal, and he feels strongly that as a lawyer who had no medical experience, who was prosecuting this company on his own, and it's clear without much support from Washington, that he could not take the action to pull a painkiller from the market, that he couldn't be the one to kill it off. He felt that the painkillers were useful to patients, that there were people who needed them, and he had neither the experience nor the knowledge of or the medical experience to be able to make that judgment. So what he hoped was that the criminal conviction would open the door to closer scrutiny by federal regulators, particularly the Food and Drug Administration, which would then take the necessary action. And I think it's quite a reasonable position for him to take, a U.S. attorney out in the Western District of Virginia, faced with this enormous decision. But it was certainly a missed opportunity for the federal government, yes.
And indeed, thanks to Giuliani's lawyering on behalf of Purdue Pharma, after the deal was made in 2007 and they were still able to sell to the U.S. government, the company sold nearly $5 billion worth of OxyContin, right?
Yes. I mean, sales just went on escalating until 2010 when the drug was reformulated to make it harder to misuse. And by then, there was enough knowledge about OxyContin that it was being marginalized in some ways. But certainly over the years, and certainly after the period for which this conviction was up to 2001, but Purdue went on mis-selling that drug for many years after 2001. In fact, in 2003, the Food and Drug Administration wrote to Purdue warning it that its advertising was making false claims for the drug, still making false claims. However, a second element of what Giuliani was able to negotiate was that the conviction would cover all actions by Purdue up until the date of the conviction in 2007. So even though Purdue had gone on mis-selling the drug for many years, it was essentially absolved from further prosecution during that period.
Well, Chris McGreal, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Chris McGreal, who's a senior writer for The Guardian US and a former correspondent for The Guardian in Jerusalem and Johannesburg. His latest article in The Guardian is Rudy Giuliani, One Deal for OxyContin Maker to Continue Sales of Drug Behind Opioid Deaths. His new book, American Overdose, The Opioid Tragedy in Three Acts, will be published in November. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Federico Garcia and assistant producer Alejandra Lariva-Latt. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.